Hey, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the second part of the course. So we're finally done with the introductory stuff that we need for everything else. So now we can start doing things that are interesting for physics. Today we're going to talk about symplectic manifolds. And this is related to Hamiltonian mechanics. But really in general to any kind of dynamics that we can do in an Hamiltonian way. Before we start with the new topic, are there any questions at all from the previous half of the course? Okay, then let's get into this. So first we need to define what the symplectic form is. So a symplectic form that I'm going to call omega, which is what people usually call it, on M, where M is some smooth manifold, is a closed, non-degenerate two-form. So it's not difficult to define this thing once you know what differential forms are. Closed, we saw last time, just means that d omega is zero. A two-form just means that it's a two-tensor. It's a covariant tensor, and it's antisymmetric. And non-degenerate is the only thing we haven't defined. Non-degenerate means that if at point A, omega A is the pair A, omega A, where now omega A is a covector at the, sorry, it's a tensor at one point, then omega A acting on two vectors, U, V, if this is zero for all possible vectors V in the tangent space at A, then this implies that u is also zero. It's a bit of a weird definition. It's an abstract one, but more concretely, in coordinates, if we can write omega locally in this form, omega ij dx I tensor dxj, because it's a tensor, so we should be able to write it like this, and then omega ij should be antisymmetric when we change ij, then if this thing is the matrix omega ij at A, so if you take all of these things, put them in a matrix, then that notion is the same as saying that the determinant of this thing is non-zero. So it's not necessarily obvious when you look at it, but if you change in coordinates and use a basis, you can see that this condition is the same as asking that the determinant is non-zero. It has nothing to do with manifolds, actually. Whenever you have some bilinear map acting on vectors, that's how you define non-degenerate, and you can show that if you take the bilinear map, represent it as a matrix, once you have a basis, then matrix must have determinant different than zero. So if you don't trust this equivalence, you can just prove it yourself. It's not complicated to do, just a linear algebra exercise. So this is everything that we need to define a symplectic form, and then a symplectic manifold is just a manifold with a symplectic form. So technically, there should be a pair of things. There's a manifold and omega. But usually, you just say M is a symplectic manifold when it has omega on it. Any questions about this definition? Should be pretty straightforward. Now, so far, it just seems like we're adding something to a manifold. And by the way, this is the first time we really see in this course a manifold with extra structure on top. Although technically we saw the bundles and those are manifolds with extra structure on top. But then I didn't tell you that. And that's going to happen in the last part of the course when we talk about bundles. Now, there are a few things that make symplectic manifold very interesting, because this definition, although it just seems, well, you just add a closed non-degenerate two-form on a symplectic manifold, that's actually a very restrictive thing. By which I mean, you cannot just take a manifold and find such a form. In general, you cannot do that. Manifolds that are symplectic are quite special. So first of all, the simplest restriction is the dimension of M has to be even. Otherwise, this doesn't work. This is simply because if you look at the matrix gamma that we defined there, omega, the determinant of omega is, because omega is anti-symmetric, is the same as the determinant of minus omega transpose. But this minus, we can take it outside, but we need to exponentiate it to the dimension of the matrix, which is the dimension of M. And then we have determinant of omega transpose, but the determinant of the transpose is the same as the determinant. So this is minus 1 to the dimension of M times determinant of omega. And now you can see that if the dimension of M is odd, then the determinant is equal to minus itself, so it must be 0. So if you are in odd dimensions, you cannot possibly have a non-degenerate two-form. Never mind the closed part, which is also not obvious. So first of all, dimension must be even. And then the second restriction comes from a theorem, which we're not going to prove, which is called Darboux theorem. The Darboux theorem tells us that if M omega is symplectic and the dimension of M is 2n, then for each point A in M, there is a chart I'm going to call u phi, and phi is going to have 2n coordinates. I'm going to give them different names. I'm going to call them q1 to qn, p1 to pn. There's a reason why we have indices up and down for the different things containing A. Such that omega, when you restrict it to u, is going to be dqi wedge dpi. So the reason why I put indices up and down is that we can use the Einstein summation convention without having to compromise whether things are supposed to be up or down. Now, the reason why this is very restrictive is that this is not saying that at a single point we can make it look like this. This is saying in a whole chart U, we can make it look like this. If you think in terms of Riemannian manifolds, this would be like saying that every Riemannian manifold is locally flat, which is obviously not true. But if you have, instead of a metric, a symplectic structure, that makes everything locally the same. So this is telling us that locally, all symplectic manifolds are the same. that is the diffeomorphic. You can find two charts in which the symplectic stuff looks exactly the same. You cannot distinguish it. And we're really going to talk about diffeomorphisms, well, isomorphisms of symplectic manifolds next lecture, maybe on Friday. So I cannot tell you the exact details, but it turns out that as symplectic manifolds, they're locally isomorphic. So this means that the differences are only global. Yes?
So if we have both metric and symplectic form on a manifold, it's necessarily Ricci flat?
No, that's a good question. So if you were to have both a metric and a symplectic manifold, that does not necessarily mean that the matrix is flat. What I'm saying is that as symplectic manifolds, they are diffeomorphic. Okay. But the metric structure is an extra thing. So the Dabot theorem will tell you, okay, so if you have a manifold which is both a symplectic structure and a Riemannian metric, and another one which is only symplectic, they are locally diffeomorphic as symplectic manifolds. It does not tell you anything about any additional structure you may have. That's a very good point. So this thing that I'm saying here, the locally all symplectic manifold looks the same as long as they don't have anything else on top of them. Whenever I do a statement about symplectic manifold, that just means that the only structure it has is being a manifold and being symplectic. And we forget about anything else it might have. If you start adding extra things, then you get other kinds of manifolds. And generally, if you have something which is both symplectic and Riemannian, you also try to impose some compatibility conditions between them, and then it becomes a whole other kind of structure, which again is going to be quite restrictive because it has to be all these plus metric and so on. But very good question. Yes?
Can you repeat the argument once again?
The what?
The argument, the last part.
This one, that the differences are global.
Locally, all symplectic manifolds are the same.
Yes, so locally they're all the same because every manifold is locally diffeomorphic to any other manifold. Because all of them look like Rn locally, so if you look locally, they all look the same. You can always map them to Rn, and then you just take a manifold, map it to Rn, map Rn back to the other manifold, and locally they look exactly the same. And then, locally, you can make the symplectic form on one manifold look like this, and the symplectic form on another manifold also look like this. So not only they look the same just as geometric spaces, also the symplectic form looks the same. I cannot make this fully precise yet because I didn't tell you what an isomorphism of symplectic manifolds is. But you should get the picture that if everything looks the same, how can you distinguish the two manifolds? That's the whole point of isomorphisms. So locally, they all look the same, which means if you want to know whether they're different, you need to look at things that are global, not local. So the differences between two topological manifolds are going to be topological things, like the number of holes they have, whether they wrap around, whether they are orientable or not, this kind of stuff. Okay, so this is it for the definition, and now I'm going to give you some examples. One of them is the easiest thing you can do, and the other one is almost the easiest thing you can do. But it's very important. So our first example is just to show you that I'm not making this thing up. These things exist. The second example is the one that really matters for us. So example one. If we take R2n, which is trivially a manifold with a single chart, this can be made into a symplectic manifold. I just define omega to be given by this. I have this matrix omega, uppercase omega, alpha beta dx alpha tensor dx beta. So x alpha just going to be the usual coordinates on Rn. And omega is a matrix that I can write in a block form in this way. So I can write it as a 2x2 block matrix. I have the 0 matrix, n by n. Let me put n subscripts as well. Then I have the identity n by n minus the identity n by n and 0 n by n. Now, this is obviously antisymmetric. And also, you can check that the determinant of omega is 1. We're not going to do this. Again, this is just some linear algebra exercise. But you can check that it is true. You need to look at the formulas for the determinants of block matrices. And also, d omega is going to be 0 because omega is constant, capital omega. So if you remember how we define the exterior derivative, you're going to have the wedge thing that's unaffected, and then you just take the derivative of this thing, but this is 0. So this is definitely a symplectic thing. If we want it to look like the Darboux theorem, we just need to redefine coordinates. So we're going to introduce new coordinates. I'm going to say the qi is xi, where I goes from 1 to n. So I'm going to take the first half of the coordinates, and I'm going to call them q. And then I take the second half of the coordinates, and I call them p. Pi is going to be xi plus n. And again, I goes from 1 to n. So I'm essentially just saying that x seen as a vector is going to be split up as qp, pretty much. And now if you look at the way omega looks like, I'm going to write the sum explicitly. Now I have the sum over alpha and beta. So if I look at alpha, alpha can go from 1 to 2n, but I'm going to split it up as alpha from 1 to n first. And then I'll do the sum for alpha that goes from n plus 1 to 2n. If alpha goes from 1 to n, we're only looking at the first half of the rows of this matrix. And omega alpha beta is going to be 0 if beta is between 1 and n. So this means that I can sum beta directly from n plus 1 to 2n. And then I'm going to have, because of where the identity is, delta alpha beta minus n. I don't know if it's obvious, there are lots of indices, but if you think in terms of indices for the matrix, you're going to get a 1 if, say, alpha is 1 and beta is n plus 1, just because of where n is. Or alpha is 2, beta is n plus 2. So if you take beta and subtract n, you should get the same as alpha, otherwise you get 0. And then you have dx alpha tensor dx beta. And then for the other half, we're going to sum. This time alpha goes from n plus 1 to 2n. But now if beta, that tells us the columns, is between 1 and n, then we get the identity, otherwise we get 0. So we only sum beta going from 1 to n. And this time we get minus delta beta is going to be the same as beta, and alpha we can write it as alpha. So in this case, you want alpha minus n again. Dx alpha tensor dx beta. It's a bit annoying because of all the indices, but hopefully it's clear why this thing is true. And at this point, we notice that these two things pretty much look the same. The only difference is that we're swapping the role of alpha and beta. Here, alpha goes from 1 to n, beta goes from n plus 1 to 2n. Here is the other way around. So I can put this together in a single sum. Alpha from 1 to n, beta from n plus 1 to 2n. And I'm just going to, in this sum, change the name of alpha and beta, which means I'm going to swap them in here, and also I want to swap them here. So this ends up being delta alpha beta minus n. And then you have dx alpha wedge dx beta. Because that's exactly dx alpha, put it here, dx alpha wedge dx beta, with the definition we gave last time. This is dx alpha tensor dx beta minus the other way around. So you get this, and then you notice that you're summing from alpha that goes from 1 to n, and then means that you're taking the q coordinates, and then beta goes from n plus 1 to 2n, so you're taking the other half of the coordinates, those are the p coordinates. So this is the same as the sum for I that goes from 1 to n, and j that goes from 1 to n. Then we have delta I, delta j, dx I wedge dx j plus n. So I essentially changed variables. I just said beta equals j plus n, and then you can just sum over j. And this is exactly dqi wedge dbi. So it's a bit annoying to do, but luckily it's the kind of thing you only have to do once. Or in my case, every time you teach this course. And you can see that we can make these coordinates look into those kind of coordinates. Sometimes it's easier to use the full coordinates, sometimes it's easier to use the other ones. It depends on exactly what you're trying to prove. So at least it shows you that the theorem makes sense in one case, and also that you can build such a matrix, such a manifold. Any questions about this example? Okay, so now we're going to do the really interesting example. If M is a smooth manifold, then T star M, the cotangent bundle, is canonically a symplectic manifold. When I say canonically here, I mean that we get it for free. We don't need to introduce any extra structure. When I made R to N into a symplectic manifold, I had to say, okay, so I'll take omega and I'll define it this way, and I just had to pull up out of nowhere that matrix capital omega. I just said, well, this is the matrix, and if you build this thing up, it works. But I could have used any other kind of antisymmetric matrix there that has the termina different than zero, and it would have still worked. So why did I choose the one is, who knows. In here, there's a specific way to choose our matrix. The way we do this is the following. Let me make sure I tell you things in order. First of all, something to mention. I already told you that while we can use the tangent bundle as the space of Lagrangian mechanics, so the configuration space where you have positions and velocities, we can interpret T star M as the space of positions and momenta. So specifically, if A alpha is an element of T star M, we can interpret A as a position and alpha as momentum. Now, while for velocities interpreted as tangent vectors, it makes perfect sense, this is not obvious why it makes sense. There are a few reasons why it makes sense, and by the end of the lecture, it will make complete sense. But for now, the idea of why this is a good thing for momentum is that, first of all, it's the dual to a tangent vector, so dual to velocity. So it makes sense that because Hamiltonian and Lagrangian mechanics are dual pictures of each other for some sense of duality, that momentum should be dual to velocities. And also it transforms the right way. When we change coordinates. So in the end, it kind of needs to be something which is a covector. But it's going to be much clearer why this is a good picture once we get to the Hamiltonian equations. Okay, so we'll do the next part in coordinates because it's considerably easier to understand. So suppose that we have coordinates q1 to qn on m. Remember that you can extend the coordinates on m and make them coordinates on t star m. So we can extend two coordinates, q1 to qn, p1 to pn on t star m. And they are defined in this way, qi of a alpha is just qi of a. Technically speaking, this q and this q are different things. This is a map that goes from t star m to r to n, to r, and this one goes from m to r. But we use the same name just because they do the same thing. And then pi of a, and then we can write any alpha at a single point. We can write it in the form alpha j, and then we have dq j a. This is the basis of the cotangent space at a. And these are things that were just done, so I'm just reminding you how it works. It just picks up the I component of this thing, so it's going to be just a alpha I. So essentially, we're just saying, use the coordinate basis of the cotangent space, write this in that basis, pick up the component with index I. Now, given this thing, we can define locally a one form, which is called the canonical one form. We call it theta, and restricted to these coordinates, it just looks like this. Pi dqi. Now, when I write this, it's important to note that this thing is a one form on t star m. I'm using these coordinates, the ones on t star m, so this is not a one form defined on m. It should be interpreted as a one form on t star m. So it's something that actually has values in t star m. It doesn't matter for us, but just something to keep in mind. Now, the problem with this definition, if I just say it like this, is I define this in coordinates, but say I change coordinates, is it going to look the same? Because otherwise, this is a completely arbitrary decision, because I picked a certain kind of chart, I define it the way, then if I change it in another chart and it looks completely different, then it's an arbitrary decision, so it's not a canonical thing. So the next thing we have to do to show it's canonical is that it does not depend on the coordinates. So suppose we change coordinates. So we're going to use a new set of coordinates, q tilde 1 to q tilde n on m. And then we induce coordinates on t star m the same way as before. So we have p tilde 1 to p tilde n, and they are defined the same way. P tilde I of A beta j dq tilde j at A. It's just picking up the I component. So I extended them in the exact same way. Now, if you do this, let's see what happens when we change between one and the other. If we take pi of a, and then we have alpha I dq tilde I, so a different index of j at a. Now, we don't know what this does, because this is only defined when the basis is dq. But we can change between one and the other. So we can write this as pi of a, and then we have alpha j dq tilde over dq, okay, evaluated at point A times dq k at A. So just the change of basis using the Jacobian. And now, the I component of this thing is the I component of this thing. So this is just going to be alpha j dq tilde j over dq k at a. Sorry, this is I. And you can check that everything makes sense, because the index I is low here and it's also low there. Now, this means that pi is actually dq tilde over dqi is j, and then we have p tilde j. So this is what I meant when I say that momenta transform the right way when you change coordinates. When you change coordinates, the momentum changes using the Jacobian matrix in the same way, or in the opposite way that it will change for the dq matrices. So now, if we look at p tilde, or let's do it the other way, pi dqi, which is our canonical bound form, then if you want to write it in this way, we notice that pi can be rewritten in terms of pj, p tilde j. So this is dq tilde j over dqi, p tilde j, dqi. But now this thing is actually dq tilde j. And the reason why it's dq tilde j is that the q tilde coordinates only depend on the q coordinates. Because I just said I have some coordinates here and I switch here. When I switch coordinates, the new coordinates do not depend on the p coordinates, because they are based on coordinates on the manifold M itself. Because otherwise, generally, you would have said something like dq tilde j is dq tilde over dq I dq I plus dq tilde j over dp I dp I. But this thing disappears. So this is something that only works because of the coordinates that were chosen. And so, we're multiplying still by this. So you can see that this equals this, so it doesn't matter which coordinates we choose, it still looks exactly the same. So the canonical one form is indeed canonical, because it does not depend on the chart we've chosen on the manifold M. It does depend on the fact that the chart on T star M is of this form, is the extended one, but that's fine because it's not an arbitrary choice. That's a reasonable thing to do. So now that we have a canonical one form, we can use it to define a canonical two form. So the canonical symplectic form is going to be just omega is minus d theta. And if you go and look at the way it's defined, if you take a serial derivative, this is just going to be minus dpi wedge dqi. And then minus makes you swap things. And so you get this. So not only it is a symplectic form, it's already in the Darboux coordinates form. And then you can extend it everywhere. And just as we saw before, because the fact that theta does not depend on the coordinates, neither does this. If I change coordinates, this is going to look like dq tilde dp tilde. And then you can easily check that it's closed. First of all, d omega equals minus d squared theta, which is always 0. So it's always closed by definition. And in particular, it's also exact. This is a special thing that happens for this kind of symplectic manifolds. Not only it's a closed form, it's automatically exact because we defined it as d of something. So it's exact just by definition. And you can see it's a form, and also because it's in the Darboux form, you already know that it is non-degenerate. Also, because we've done this before, locally it looks like the one on R2n, and the one on R2n, we already know it's non-degenerate. So this is the example that really matters for us, because if we interpret t star m as position and momenta, then we automatically, for free, get a symplectic structure on it. And as we're about to see, symplectic structures mean dynamics. So we can do dynamics on these things. And that's what we're about to see next. Any questions on this example? Yes?
For this equation where you crossed out the dp, dp term, that one.
This one, yes.
Could you explain that again? I missed it.
Yes, so in general, because the coordinates are, so the coordinates are q tilde, p tilde. So in general, if I change coordinates, I need to do the Jacobian, but with respect to all possible coordinates. So in theory, you should have dq tilde over dqi, but also dq tilde over dpi. And then you multiply by these things. So you're just doing the Jacobian thing, but with all possible things. But q tilde were coordinates on m. And on m, the other coordinates were qi, q1 to qn. There is no notion of p coordinates in here. So this means that when I want to transition from this to this, there is no dependence on the p coordinates. The q tilde coordinates don't know about the p coordinates. The p coordinates are defined in terms of the q's, but the q's are defined independently. So when you change coordinates, this part doesn't matter. It's always going to be 0.
Okay.
And that's specifically what allows this whole construction to work. Okay, so now for the fun part, and also to answer an important question, why do we care? Why do we want symplectic structures in the first place? To answer this question, first of all, let me tell you how do we define dynamics, because the answer is dynamics. using symplectic forms allows us to have dynamics on our manifold. But in which ways? What does it mean to have dynamics? So first of all, it's not just any dynamics, but first order dynamics, which means first order differential equations. And not just any, just ordinary differential equations. So let's first see how we can talk about differential equations in a geometric way. Because so far, you only know how to do differential equations on Rn. On a manifold, how do we define a differential equation? The usual way we do this is this. The ingredients are going to be a curve defined in some open interval in R. To M, this is going to be a curve. And a vector field X that goes from M to Tm. A differential equation, when you think about it, an ordinary differential equation is simply telling you that you have a curve, which is a solution of your equation if its derivative does something. But the derivative of a curve at each point is a vector. And in general, if you put all together the points, it's going to be a vector field. So a differential equation actually looks like this. Gamma dot at t equals x evaluated at gamma t. And then you have some initial conditions like this. The only thing I had to tell you is, what exactly is this object? Because can we just take derivatives? Kind of. So gamma dot t is going to be the tangent vector to gamma at point gamma of t. Remember when in the tutorial I showed you, well, you really showed yourself, that you can connect derivations and tangent vectors? That's what we're doing. Geometrically, it's the tangent vector. As a derivation, gamma dot t takes a function f and gives us, as a result, f composed gamma prime at t. And if you remember, this is pretty much how you defined derivations in terms of curves in the tutorial. The only thing I changed is that the point, instead of being 0, the one where your base is just t, which is arbitrary. You can move it around. But you can always think as reparametrizing the curve. So this is the differential equation in geometric forms. You're saying that your solutions are curves such that the tangent at each point of the curve equals your vector field at the point. So the vector field is the thing that encodes the dynamics. So pretty much, if you want a first order differential equation, you have to give me a vector field and an initial condition. And then you just say the solutions are the curves that satisfy this. And by the way, just as a name, this thing are called, when this happens, you say gamma is an integral curve of x. Graphically, what you're doing is giving me a vector field, which means at every point, you're giving me arrows and you're telling me what the vector field looks like. Then you start at the point and you say the solution follows the lines. So this is kind of boring. It will just do this. But if you have something which is circular vector field, then the solution starts at the point, then it starts moving. You always follow the tangent using the vector field, and that's how you end up with your solution. Any questions about this picture? Okay, so just one thing to note, because we're assuming that a vector field is smooth, this differential equation already always has a solution, and it's always unique. So all those things about differential equations not necessarily having unique solutions or solutions at all, there are theorems about existence and uniqueness. They require some properties on your vector field, but if it's smooth, all of those properties are satisfied. Yes?
What happens if your vector field vanishes at one point? Then your curves sort of just stop.
The curve can have a zero tangent. It doesn't have to stop. For example, if the curve does something like this, the tangent needs to change direction. It can get zero at some point. There's nothing wrong with that. Remember, the tangent to the curve, if the curve is a physical thing, so now just think physics, if that's actually the position of a particle as time increases, there's nothing wrong with the velocity being zero at some point. If I throw this up, and I'm going to do that, I'm going to break it, but if I throw this up, it's going to go up with some velocity, then it's going to stop, and then it's going to go down. The velocity is going to become zero. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Yes?
Generalize this to PDEs somehow.
PDEs are more complicated. You can still do geometric things with PDEs, but it's not this easy. You need a whole other kind of structure on your space. You need to talk about jet bundles. So it's not obvious, but you can do it. So there is a whole area of differential equations on manifolds, but it's a lot simpler if they are ordinary differential equations. The thing you can do, though, say if you want to do Hamiltonian mechanics for fields, there are two ways of doing it. The more common way is the one where you pretend that you are actually doing ODE in infinite dimensions. So you can, instead of treating it as fields, you think, okay, so the space of fields is infinite dimensional, but this is really an ODE on fields. But it's just that instead of being a curve that at each time gives you a point, it's a curve that each time gives you a field. So you could do that. But then you have to worry about infinite dimensional matrices. Manifolds, which is still non-obvious, or you can treat it as an actual PDE and then you have to define the whole structure for PDEs. But either way is difficult. There is no easy way around it. They're just two different kinds of difficult. One is there's a lot of structure, the other one is things that are infinite dimensional. But it can be done. Okay, so is it clear how this thing works? Okay, so now let me show you why asymplectic structure is important. So what's on the board should tell you that if I give you a vector field, I'm giving you dynamics, because I can tell you just the physical curves are the ones that are integral curves of the vector field. The problem is, where does the vector field come from? Generally, I cannot just tell you this is the vector field. I don't know what the vector field is. So think classical mechanics. Usually, what do I give you?
Potential.
Right, a potential, for example. And from the potential, you want to find out everything else. The potential is a function. So somehow we need to take the function and make it into a vector field. The symplectic form is something that allows us to do that. So the power of the symplectic form we take functions and we map them into vector fields. So instead of doing something like, I had to somehow randomly come up with the vector field, I can say I have a function. I want to give it some very cool special name. I'm going to call it the Hamiltonian. And then that gives you a vector field. And then that gives you differential equations. So that's our plan. So how do we do this? Well, if f that goes from m to r is a smooth function, then we define its Hamiltonian vector field, which is usually denoted by x with an f subscript, in this way. We're going to say that xf is the vector field such that omega acting on, let me check in which position it goes, on xf dot equals df. So that's how we define it. Now we are interpreting this thing here as a one form. So all I'm saying here is that omega is a map that takes two vector fields as input. If I fill one of the inputs with xf, now the remaining object only has one input, which is a vector field. This is the Abelson notation we talked about last time. Remember, there was the Abelson notation where even though this is technically not a map that acts on vectors, we can interpret it as such. This is a common thing. You actually have seen this for sure in general relativity. I don't know if you've seen it exactly in this form, but this is what you do when you take a vector field and map it into a covector. What we're saying here is that I have a vector field, and I take omega, and out of the vector field, I come up with a one form. And then additionally, and saying that form is the derivative of something. So you can actually use this on functions. And just as an aside, if you have a metric, and if you try to do the same thing, then it turns out that this is the definition of the gradient of a function. Exactly the same thing. So just as this, whenever you have, really, whenever you have a non-degenerate two form, you can take a function and you can associate a vector field to it. So you could try to do this with a metric, but the differential equations you end up with are kind of boring. They don't encode something that you will think as dynamics. Okay, so you can do this, and in coordinates, in general, xf is going to look like this. It's going to look like ai d over dqi plus bi d over dpi. Because dqi, dpi are going to form a frame in our coordinates for all vector fields. And then, if you take omega and feed it the thing, what's going to happen? Omega of xf dot is going to be, let's see, where do we have it written down? Here. Omega is dqi wedge dpi, which is dqi tensor dpi minus dpi tensor dqi. So now when I feed the vector field to this, I'm feeding it to the first argument, and then I'm getting a number, really a function, and then I'm multiplying by the second one. So if you take ai dqi plus bi dpi, and I feed it to the first entry does not care about the dpi, because this is the dual frame. So you're going to get the delta. So the q coordinates are matched with the q coordinates, the p coordinates are matched with the p coordinates. So for the first entry, you only take the first half, the one with the i, and then you're left with the dpi. So you're just feeding this to this to get the delta, and then you multiply by this. And then you also have the second half. When you feed it to this, it gives you nothing. But when you feed it to this, it gives you something. So you get the minus bi dqi. So in this sense, you can interpret this as a one form because now it's a linear combination of the coframe fields. And then if you look at just df, this is just df at over dqi dqi plus df at over dpi dpi. So now you're just equating the two of them. And because the dqi and the dpi at each point form a basis, you're really equating the components. So in coordinates, xf actually looks like this. You have df at over dpi d over dqi minus df at over dqi d over dpi. So in coordinates, this is the Hamiltonian vector field. We don't have time to talk about this today, but you see that if you were to act with this thing on a function, then you actually get the Poisson bracket. Because that has the derivative of 1 with respect to p, derivative of f with respect to q, then you apply this on some other function g, and you actually end up with the Poisson bracket. But we'll see this next time. In the couple of minutes we have left, I just want to show you how we get the actual equations. Probably want to keep these visible. Give me a moment. Okay, so the plan now is that I'll give you a special function. That thing that I did there, that can be done for any function. Even though it's called the Hamiltonian vector field, it does not have to be the Hamiltonian. You can do Hamiltonian vector fields on any functions you want. But in particular, we have a special function, h that goes from m to r, which we call the Hamiltonian. I had to give you this function somehow. If you're doing classical mechanics, it's going to be kinetic energy minus plus potential energy, but you could come up with any kind of Hamiltonian. And then I'm going to define the vector field xh, and then I use this construct, and I just say that the physical paths they're going to be solutions of the differential equation gamma dot t equals xh at gamma t with some initial condition like this. Now let's see what happens in coordinates. Xh is going to be dh at over dpi d over dqi minus dh at over dqi d over dpi. Now for gamma dot in coordinates, suppose that the coordinates of gamma at t, we write them like this. This is really an abuse of notation, because this should be something like q1t, or qit really should be qi composed gamma evaluated at t. It's just not very nice if we do that all the time. So I'm just going to think of qi at t as being the function itself. Then if we use this abuse of notation, gamma dot t as a derivation in a basis is going to be given by, we get q dot I at t, and now this is a function that goes from r to r, so we can take the derivative, d over dqi, plus p dot I t d over dpi. This is just, in general, the way you define that vector field, the one that I defined right there. You can check it easily just because of the way it's defined. Naturally, you have done this already in the tutorial. Now, if you just equate this with this, you're going to find that the equations are actually q dot I equals, you have to equal the things that have this basis vector, dh at over dpi, and then p dot I equals dh at with the minus over dqi. So in coordinates, these things are actually exactly the Hamilton's equations. And this is true for any symplectic manifold. It does not have to be our actual example of T star M. So T star M, that's how we do classical mechanics in an Hamiltonian way using a symplectic manifold. But this is true for any kind of symplectic manifold. So as an example, which I may show you at some point in the tutorial if we have time, you can actually do quantum mechanics in this way. You can take quantum mechanics, put a symplectic form on your Hilbert space, and do dynamics using Hamilton's equations. So this is not a classical mechanics thing. This is a dynamics more generally defined thing. Any questions about this thing? Yes?
Is there a motivation for why we chose a two-form instead of just a two-tensor to start with?
Right, so why do we choose a two-form instead of a covariant to tensor? I don't know if I have an obvious way of why we do that. So if you choose a covariant tensor in general, all those properties, like the Darboux chart, are not necessarily going to hold. So you could. Nothing stops you from doing that. But if you choose this particular form, you end up with Hamilton's equations. When I said earlier, if you were to do this, if you use a metric, this is not anymore anti-symmetric. In fact, it's symmetric, but it's still a covariant to tensor. It does not have any sense to us that it's closed because it's not a different to form, but it's non-degenerate. So you could try to do this, and if you do this, then your differential equations are going to be kind of boring because you're just going to say that your differential equation is something that looks like gamma dot is the gradient of a function. So you can do it. It just, the equations you get are not Hamilton's equations, which is generally what you would like to get when you do these things. So the real plan is to come up with a function and then have some structure geometrically that gives you a vector field associated to the function that gives you Hamilton's equations back. And actually, as it turns out, you don't even need the symplectic structure to do any of this. The symplectic structure is useful, but there's something less restrictive that gives you the same results. And that's the Poisson bracket. We'll see this next time. There's a different kind of structure, which is just a Poisson bracket on a manifold. And if you only give it that, it's called a Poisson manifold. And a Poisson manifold does the same thing. There's something, which is the Poisson bracket, that takes functions and maps them into vector fields. And it actually maps them in the same way as the omega does. And a symplectic manifold is always also a Poisson manifold. I mentioned earlier that if you look at the vector field XF, if you act on some other function, you get the Poisson bracket. That's exactly how you define it for this case. But the other way still gives you the same results. It's not true that every Poisson manifold is symplectic, but every Poisson manifold gives you Hamilton's equations. So that's a more general thing. And a cool thing about that is that it does not have to be even dimensional anymore. Poisson manifolds are allowed to be odd dimensional. So you can generalize this notion to something that has three dimensions, for example. Are there any other questions? Okay, well then that's all for today, and we'll continue these things on Wednesday.